This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. The religious landscape in the country is undergoing a tectonic shift, and it is as jarring as it is unprecedented. 5 years ago, 15% of American adults were religiously affiliated. Unaffiliated. Today, that number has jumped to 20%. One in five American adults and one-third of adults under 30 say they have no religious affiliation. That means they're atheists, agnostics, humanists, or just uninterested in joining a church, synagogue, or mosque. But divorce from a religious community comes with a big quandary when it comes to raising children, as many religiously unaffiliated parents are finding out, including one of my guests today. Catherine Osment's big story in Boston Magazine, Losing Our Religion, explores the quandary that child-rearing poses for the religiously unaffiliated, the nuns, as they're called, as in the answer to the question, what's your religious affiliation? None. And she's with me now in the studio. And Catherine Osment, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And fascinating piece. And listeners, by the way, we've posted a link to that piece called Losing My Religion. So, Catherine, what's going on out there? Why are so many people, 20% and rising, identifying themselves without religious affiliation?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons we talked about in my story was it could well be a backlash against the religious right. A lot of people I talk to who were raised with some Christian faith are sort of hedging on calling themselves Christian these days. The religious right has sort of co-opted that word to mean something that they're not comfortable with. Mm. That could be part of it. There are other things. The divorce rate in the 70s, studies have shown that may have contributed to this, that kids who grew up in a home with just one parent were not as likely to go to church. Mm. And so maybe they're not passing that something on to their kids. Some people suggest it might be our mobility. We're not living close to our parents and to the church we may or may not have been raised in. So there's a lot of demographic changes going on. I think there's no one reason why there's nuns, but there are a lot of different reasons.
A lot of different reasons. And what's happening out there is fairly dramatic and fairly measurable. Now, you're one of these people, these so-called nuns. And I'd like to talk to you about sort of, and what's great about your article is you really explore your personal journey here. So sketch out your story and the way you were raised and this quandary that you began to face when it came to your own children.
Sure. So both of my parents were raised in small town Arkansas in very religious families. My mother hosted Bible study in high school, and my grandmother was a Christian missionary to Guyana. So I had religious roots, in my ancestry. But things changed, I think, in the 60s and 70s. And by the time I came around, my parents were living in Connecticut. They were on the brink of divorce. Our family kind of splintered. Mm. So I was raised with sort of a hybrid of Protestant strains, but nothing that ever really stuck for me. When it came time to get married, I entered into an interfaith marriage. My husband is Jewish, another trend that's on the increase and which statistics show may keep people from joining or, having their kids join any kind of organized religion. So all of these things sort of came together for me. And recently my son turned 10 and I looked up and said to my husband, we've kind of forgotten to give him religion. And so that's where we are right now. And that's what sort of catapulted me into writing this story, was wondering, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? How much does this matter?
Well, let me read just a brief piece that you wrote, because the question about is this a good thing, mm-hmm. I think, is really embodied in this question. You write, participation in a religious community has been correlated with everything from self-esteem and overall hopefulness to the avoidance of substance abuse and teen pregnancy. And you write that you began to worry, am I depriving my children of an experience that will help shape their identities in a positive way and anchor them throughout mm-hmm. their lives? Big, big, big questions. Mm-hmm. And questions that a lot of us who are parents of kids who consider ourselves unaffiliated religiously mm-hmm. are grappling with.
Yes.
So are you depriving them of something essential here?
Here's the realization I came to as I wrote the story and I talked to more and more parents. I found parents like me everywhere I turned. Every time I brought up the story to a friend, they said, I have to read that story. That's exactly what I'm going through. And here's what I came away with, is that you might be a nun, but that doesn't mean you're nothing. And that your kids are not not nothing because they're not being raised in a religious organization. And the more closely I looked at what we were doing in our family and how our kids were behaving, I saw that we're really raising these ethical, caring, kind, curious children who care deeply about the world that they live in. They want to help people. We walk through Central Square and they tug at my sleeve to say, give me some money that I can give to this homeless person. There's just this real strong urge in them to help other people. And I think they're being raised great, you know.
So but you came to this conclusion after you sort of went on a little bit of a quest, maybe, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you sort of explored secular humanism, you sort of explored
yes.
Unitarian Universalism, and you even took this quiz, the Beliefomatic
yes.
quiz, which I'd never heard
right.
about, which sounds, tell us about that, sort of
right.
what that turned up.
So I thought, well, I need to figure out just what I am. Maybe part of the problem here is I don't know what I believe, or I've never really put it into words. It's been a really long time. So I went online and signed up with beliefomatic.com, and you type in your answers to various questions, and it will send you an email and tell you which religion you are most correlated with based on your answers. And mine came up, you know, secular humanist, and it was the first I'd really heard of that, to be yeah. honest. I mean, I'd heard of it, but I didn't really know exactly what it was. So then I started looking deeper, and it was just kind of nice to know there was a name for what I believed. I always thought, well, if you're not Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or, you know, Muslim, then you're kind of in the squishy nether region. Well, it was nice to know that there's something called secular humanism that represents a lot of what I do believe. And so again, I came back to this point that just because I'm not in a religious organization doesn't mean I don't believe in things. Mm-hmm. I don't have a real grounding in a lot of these important aspects of life.
Listeners, we're talking with Catherine Osment. She's a Boston-based freelance writer. Her cover story in the current issue of Boston Magazine is called Losing Our Religion. We're talking about the nuns, those who have who choose none for religious affiliation. So we want to ask you to join the conversation. Is organized religion a critical part of your child's upbringing or not? And is keeping kids out of the pews selling them short in any way? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also post a comment on Facebook or Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me bring a couple of more guests into this conversation. Thomas Groom is chair of the Department of Religious Education and Pastoral Ministry at Boston College's School of Theology and Ministry. And Thomas Groom, great to have you. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, Anthony. Nice to be here.
And Chris Stedman is the assistant humanist chaplain at Harvard and author of Faithiest, How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious. Chris Stedman, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Thomas Groom, let me start with you. What does the explosion in this number of religiously unaffiliated Americans say to you about what families like Catherine's are dealing with and other big questions?
Well, it says many things, Anthony, but the first thing is quite positive that it says, because Charles Taylor, one of the great sociologists of our time, says that we've moved to have an alternative to religious belief. And the alternative is what he calls an exclusive humanism.
Hmm.
He calls it exclusive only in the sense that it excludes any referent to a divine or to a transcendent perspective. In other words, we basically make our own meaning, our own sense, our own morals, and so on, and that is a valid alternative to religious belief. Now, at one point, you could be very religious people like myself could be very threatened by that, but on the other hand, it makes the choice of faith a very free choice, that you don't become a religious person just because, as Catherine said, your grandmother was a missionary or your mother taught Bible school. In other words, there's a real choice now in people's ability to our disposition to be people of a religious faith. And if they don't particularly, if they don't find what they're looking for, and I often say there's nothing more life-giving than good religion, there's nothing more dangerous and destructive than bad religion.
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't find what they're looking for in the great religious traditions, then the fact that they can turn to some kind of secular humanism is consoling. Now, I suppose from my perspective, I still believe and I'm convinced that is not as humanizing as a good religion can be.
And tell us why, because I'm interested in that. Because, of course, we mentioned these studies that do correlate good outcomes for children who are sort of raised in a family with religion. I'm wondering if you can explain that.
Well, the old Catholic tradition, of course, is there is a natural law that all of us have that God has ensconced within each and every person. And by reflecting on our own lives and our experiences and using our reason, we can indeed discern the good from the bad and choose the good. And so, in other words, we can be ethical people without religion. So it's not as if we need religion in order to live well. Lots of religious people are not ethical, and lots of non-religious people are very ethical. So there's no, it's not a question of ethics, although indeed the ethics of a religious faith confirms a person in one's convictions and commitments and so on. But I think it's a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, a sense of overarching view, a sense of what life is all about, that it can give people a certain resource in the day-to-day living, not just at the high times and the low times, for the weddings and the wakes, as it were, but also in the ordinary and everyday, that a religious faith can be a tremendously enriching type of perspective. And to share that with children, as if there is ultimate meaning and purpose and design and so in our world and in our own lives, can be a real resource, can be what we might call in religious language a blessing.
And Chris Stedman, let me come to you. How are humanists like yourself trying to fill the void that's being, I guess, created by this exodus from religious affiliation?
Well, in Catherine's wonderful piece, she sat down with Robert Putnam and spoke with him about this
trend. The Harvard sociologist,
yes.
Right.
And a couple of years ago, he and David Campbell released a book called American Grace. It was an extensive study of the lives of religious Americans. And in that book, they found that religious Americans are much more civically engaged than the non-religious. They give more to charity, they're more likely to participate in volunteer efforts, and so on. But they actually found that the correlation between religious affiliation and civic engagement had less to do with the intensity of an individual's religious beliefs and more to do with how involved they were in their religious communities. They actually found that a non-religious or non-believing spouse of a religious person who attended and participated in the community with them was equally likely to be civically engaged. And they speculated that moral non-religious communities could serve a similar function in equipping and inspiring people to be civically minded and civically participating. And so we at the humanist community at Harvard believe that this is true, that non-religious people still seek and desire many of the same kinds of structures that religious communities provide. That's something that we try to offer at the humanist community at Harvard. We're piloting a secular Sunday school this year. We have all kinds of community service projects and interfaith dialogue programs, which Catherine referenced in her article. And, you know, I find these kinds of things to be very meaningful, and to be able to connect them to my secular humanist identity is important to me, because my humanist identity speaks to my values, and it speaks to my place in a very religiously diverse society as a non-religious person who grew up in a non-religious household, but found religion when I was much younger. But why I became religious when I was young is because I was seeking the kind of structure and the kind of ethical framework for addressing life's big questions.
And you've had a bit of a journey yourself, right? I mean, you were a fundamental Christian at one point.
Yeah.
A fundamentalist Christian, sorry, at one point.
Well, I grew up in a household very similar to Catherine's, the one that she's currently in the process of developing. And I became a fundamentalist Christian when I was 11 because I grew up without really any sort of language for what my identity was in a religiously diverse society. I had a good friend who lived just up the road from me who was very involved in her synagogue, and I began to wonder if there was something missing from my life. And when I was 11, some friends invited me to this after-school youth group for this non-denominational, very fundamentalist Christian community. And it offered a lot of what I felt like I was missing. And looking back now, I think my mother, I know because we've talked about it, she wishes that we had had more conversations about what it means to grow up without religion, because not talking about it made it seem like maybe there was something wrong with it, or maybe we just didn't have any identity or values. And I think that, you know, I'm very grateful that Catherine has written this piece and that she's having those conversations with her children, because I think it will help children who don't have that kind of religious identification in their life feel like, as Catherine said, they're not nothing.
Yeah. Catherine, you raise such an interesting sort of heart of the quandary here. You suggested that a lot of us reject religion because, or decided to reject religion because it was sort of forced on us, so we rejected it. So we decided to raise our own kids without religion, with this idea that we're freeing them from what we went through. But then you ask, and this is the great question, that aren't we just perpetuating the cycle and foisting our non-belief, our secular humanism, our atheism, our agnosticism, or whatever it is, on our kids? And it's a great question, and I want to know sort of how you answered that.
Yeah, that was Phil Zuckerman, who I spoke with, who's this secular studies professor out at Pitzer College in California, brought that up. He said, secular parents are in a really kind of a tough bind because they don't want to be hypocritical. They've sort of rejected the religion they've grown up with, but they don't want to then be foisting, you know, humanism on their kids, because then they're doing what their parents did to them, and it's the same thing, just with a different name. I think the way to do it, and the way we do it in our home, is to be open to all ideas. So what we'll talk about is, we don't particularly believe that, but grandma does, or your aunt believes this, and, your cousins are Jewish and they believe very strongly in the Hebrew school that they go to, so that we can point to different examples in their lives who are people they are very close with and show there's a variety of approaches here, and hope that someday they'll come to one that makes sense for them.
Hmm. We have a lot of listeners who want to get on this conversation. But before I go, Thomas Groom, I want to just ask you sort of about this conversation in general. That is, what is it about parenthood in particular that prompts this sort of reassessment of religious identity, I guess?
Well, it's such an existential decision for you to make. I mean, you're going to pass on a worldview, an outlook on life, a self-understanding to this child, whether you intend to or not. So there's no pristine, pure place to stand. There's no point, as Catherine says, in saying as a parent, I won't give them an outlook on life. I won't give them a value system. I won't give them a self-understanding or a sense of the purpose and meaning of it all. We do it inevitably in the day-to-day living of our lives and parenting. So then you begin to say, well, golly, what kind of a one do I want them to have? Now, I want them to certainly to play piano, and I want them to skate, and I want them to ski, and I want them to... So do I also want them to have this kind of an ultimate horizon to their lives? And will that be life-giving for them? Will it be life-giving not only for them, but for the life of the world? In other words, will it make them good people, better citizens, and so on? And will they find more purpose and meaning if I share a religious perspective with them? Or will, indeed, is secular humanism equally effective? So I think we have to make those kind of existential decisions. It's not as if we can stand aloof from them and simply say, well, I won't do that. We do it inevitably.
Listeners, we're talking today about the religiously unaffiliated and their children. Is organized religion a critical part of a child's upbringing? Is it a part of your child's upbringing? Give us a call, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from Lexington. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind, Bill?
Well, I was calling. I heard the discussion, and I am not a particularly faithful. I consider myself an atheist, but we're raising, my wife and I are raising our kids in a church. We take them to church, and they are there because we think it gives them sort of another point of balance in their life where they can interact with kids and adults. And sort of get the behavior and learn more about sort of what are ethical behaviors.
So it sounds like, Bill, you're really talking about a sort of ethical community that you're looking for.
It's a church. Mm-hmm. We go to a church every Sunday, and it's there are services. They go to religious education. They have a religious growth and learning classes. They discuss comparative religions. It's a Unitarian church. They don't necessarily... it's a shared faith without a creed, so the kids are actually encouraged to develop their own thoughts on God and whether they believe in God or their own thoughts on religion. And the kids spend time going to other faith communities. They'll go to Hindu temples, they go to Jewish synagogues.
Interesting.
I think they go to Catholic churches to understand more about other faiths, but they have a place outside of school, outside of sports and external activities, where they're learning about, behavior and things like that.
Got it, Bill. Thanks so much for the call. We really appreciate it. Catherine, I mean, I do hear in Bill's question this sort of search, and you raised this in your piece, that in many ways this is a quest for community.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that studies have shown that that's the greatest payoff that people feel when they go to church. They get this feeling of community. I saw it when I visited First Parish Church in Arlington, another Unitarian Universalist church, and I saw these kids who have really created this bond together that they don't have anywhere else in their lives. And I felt a feeling of, wow, wouldn't that be nice to give my kids that? And then the next weekend rolled around and I just didn't get around to it. I mean, I can't be someone I'm not. I don't think I'm going to join a church or a synagogue. Part of it is my husband's Jewish, and I don't think he's going to join the Unitarian Church with me. So I think we have to figure out who we are. There's no question. Church has been serving human need for millennia, and it's very good at it. It does do wonderful things for people.
Let's take another call. Dana is calling from Barnstable. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. Very interesting conversation. But, you know, I think there's something that we're not thinking about here. I think I was a former evangelical Christian. Now I'm an agnostic. It was never forced on me at all, even though I was brought up that way. I willingly embraced it. But, you know, I think we're just missing, we're forgetting the fact that labels like Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Islam, Buddhists are labels, and they're useful. I'm not saying we should obliterate them, but, you know, like, I just got the impression from the author of this piece, forgive me, I've forgotten the name already. But
this is Catherine Osmond. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Osmond. Okay. Pardon me, but, you know, you said, like, we're in some netherworld, some squishy netherworld, some kind of in-between world, but, you know, labels tend to do that. If I can't classify myself as this, I have to classify myself as that. And is that even necessary? I mean, like...
Well, Dana, you put a good point on the table, and I want to get through some more calls, but I want to put your question right to Catherine and my other guests. Are we hung up on labels here, or respond to Dana's concern?
Well, this is what's interesting about the nuns, because the nun is now this new label that's supposed to incorporate, you know, 20% of the country, and they're a wildly diverse group of people. Mm. I mean, within that nun group, you've got complete, you know, atheists who don't believe in God at all, and you've got people like my friend who I quote in the article, Genevieve, who's a deeply religious person but doesn't want to join a church, and you've got sort of everything in between. So I think the caller makes a great point. Even this label nun isn't really quite fair to who it's representing.
Yeah. Chris Stedman, what do you hear in that question?
Yeah, there have been some really great studies on the nuns recently, and every time I read them, I just find myself wanting to know more. I think that it's, as Catherine mentioned, it's this very nebulous group of people that contains a lot of different folks. You know, 12, according to Pew, 12% of the nuns identify as atheist and 17% identify as agnostic. But among those folks, 36% claim to believe in a God or a universal spirit. So labels do, I think, make it difficult to really understand what it is a lot of these nuns believe, because, you know, what do they mean when they say God or universal spirit, or what do they mean when they say atheist or agnostic? And this is, you know, my book, Faithiest, is about, you know, my sort of evolution from growing up non-religious to becoming a fundamentalist Christian to becoming an atheist. And every step along the way, it was, you know, this idea of having to identify a label and then, you know, moving from there into trying to have conversations with people who have other labels. A lot of the book addresses the role of atheists in interfaith dialogue. I think that labels do tend to, as much as they're useful and sort of a natural way of categorizing people and information, they are complicated because people bring a whole set of assumptions along with them. And I think what makes the nuns particularly interesting and challenging for people right now is that they don't know what assumptions to assign the nuns, because it contains so many different people with so many different perspectives, and we still don't know that much about who all these folks are.
Let's take a call. Susan is calling from Weston. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. So I just want to make a couple of quick points. One of the things that I feel is missing from this conversation is the aspect of the cultural aspect of religious upbringing. My husband's Jewish. I was raised Christian. So we were kind of trying to figure out how to address things with our children, although neither one of us was particularly observant at the time that they were born. We ended up talking to them about the identity of our religious upbringing, how it sort of identifies our families, and then the things that so many religions have in common. So much of what's positive is common belief in religions. My kids are now both young adults. My son, when he was in high school, went on his own, and I mean by himself, to various churches, the Episcopal Church and the Congregational Church, and he is now a Quaker, but, you know, found a place, a spiritual community that he felt comfortable with. And I just think that that cultural aspect, when you talk about passing on your religious beliefs to your children, sometimes there's more richness in that.
Susan, it's a great point, and let us pick it up right now. Thomas Groom, you're nodding your head when Susan made a reference to that cultural aspect of religious upbringing.
Yes, Anthony. No, and it was a point that the Bill's question suggested to me earlier on as well, or comment. I think Susan hits the nail on the head in many ways, because it's not just a question of beliefs and perspectives. It's a question of practices. The beginning of Catherine's wonderful essay, she talks about the Greek Orthodox having a procession and her own efforts then at Easter time to have whatever it was, Easter bunnies or eggs or something. But there's something that Chris mentioned his book, so I'll take the liberty. I just published a little collection of essays with my wife, Dr. Colleen Griffith, called Catholic Spiritual Practices. And in many ways, it comes down to the practices. Yes, indeed, it's the beliefs and the creeds we claim, but it's really the practices, the cultural aspects of it, that's in a sense what gives a person a sense of an identity. And the practices are far less likely to turn out fundamentalists. Fundamentalism in any religion, including the nuns, is dangerous and is terribly limited and cannot survive in our contemporary world. So it doesn't surprise me when somebody rejects a fundamentalist perspective and moves on to something else. But the point that I would make is that it's not so much the belief creeds that we cling to, it's more the practices, the cultural trappings and expressions of this faith and of this community and of this tradition, that then that sense of belonging, that sense of belonging to an old people, an ancient people, a great Jewish people, Protestant people, Catholic people, that's what it can do for people, it seems to me.
And Catherine, how have you dealt with that in your family? As you say, you have your husband is Jewish, this passing on of this cultural tradition, how have you dealt with that?
Well, we do what a lot of interfaith couples do, and we do all the Jewish and Christian holidays. And not much in between, but you know, my kids, my son, you know, read the Hebrew prayer at Hanukkah every night when we were lighting the candles. So he's getting some of that culture. You know, I will say, many of the people I met while researching this story said that was a big problem for them. They missed the music, they missed the architecture, they missed the sound of the prayers or the cadence of, you know, the minister's voice. There were real, just these tangible things about the rituals that they missed. I was heartened, though, to learn that, you know, people like the humanist chaplain at Harvard will do secular rituals for people. And there are people who are trying to come up with sort of a secular version of a bar mitzvah, say, or, you know, a baby naming ceremony, so that you can bring some of what you know, your culture that you're creating, especially in an interfaith marriage, you're kind of creating something new. You can bring in some of the old and make it something new that works for your whole family.
Well, Catherine Osment, your piece raised some great questions. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for coming in and talking to us about it. It's really been fascinating.
Thank you.
That's Catherine Osment. She's a Boston-based freelance writer. Her cover story in the current issue of Boston Magazine is Losing Our Religion. Also joining us was Thomas Groom. He's the chair of the Department of Religious Education and Pastoral Ministry at Boston College's School of Theology and Ministry. Thomas Groom, thank you. Always a
pleasure. You're welcome. Thank you, Anthony.
And Chris Stedman, assistant humanist chaplain at Harvard and author of Faithiest, How an Atheist Found Common Ground with the Religious. Chris Stedman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, the conversation continues. Brian Vaith writes on Facebook, I'm an atheist, but I attend church weekly with my children. I want them to question the existence of God later in life. But while they're too young to grasp the concept of religious choice, I'd like them to be raised within the religious structure. So the conversation continues on Facebook at Radio Boston, also at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, the Patriots looked pretty good yesterday, although they lost Gronkowski. We'll look ahead at the AFC Championship game with sports writer Peter May. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.